It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Annie Feit. Today we're talking about climbing Denali. Every year, about 1,200 mountaineers attempt to summit North America's highest peak. It's still early in the climbing season, but a few groups are already on the mountain. By mid-May, base camp on the Kahiltna Glacier will turn into a small tent village filled with mountaineers from around the world. Today we're going to talk about what it takes to climb Denali, what the risks are, and how the National Park Service manages the climbing season. With me are three people who have decades of experience on the mountain. Colby Coombs is a climbing guide who owns Alaska Mountaineering School. He's in the studio with me. Hi, Colby.
Hi, Annie.
Brian Okunik is on the phone from his home in Talkeetna. He first climbed the mountain in the 1970s and spent two decades as a guide on Denali. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Annie.
And also on the phone from Talkeetna is National Park Service Mountaineering Ranger Tucker Chenoweth. Hi, Tucker.
Hello.
And Tucker, I want to start with you. Can you kind of set the scene for us? How many people are on the mountain right now, and what are you and the other rangers doing to get ready for the climbing season?
We flew over this morning. We're trying to gauge what... If we could get our camps in today, and we saw the three people that are currently on the mountain headed up. So right now there's three climbers. There's another five that are headed in today, so not many people up there currently.
Okay, and is that typical for this time of year?
Yeah, for Denali, it is. The people kind of starting to go in there at the end of April, and there's a pretty big wave right on their heels that'll probably start showing up here in the next few days.
So it ramps up quickly when it does ramp up?
Yeah, it starts out super slow like now, and then by the time we get into mid-May, we're full swing.
And how many people are registered to climb Denali this year?
Currently, we have 800 registered climbers, which is a little bit low compared to previous years. However, the registration process isn't fully over for the season yet, so we're expecting to see around 1,000 to 1,100 climbers registered for the whole season.
And can you describe kind of how that registration process goes? I mean, what do people have to do to climb
sure.
this mountain?
One of the big requirements is you have to do a little pre-planning before you come here. It's not one of these mountains that you can just have a conversation in the bar and head up. Well, maybe with the exception of the early sourdough expedition. But now there's a 60-day pre-registration requirement. So you have to send in an application that lists your team members. And once we receive that, then we will review it, see if there's any holes or we have any questions for you, and then we can get you on the mountain and issue a permit.
And do you have to prove that you have climbed other big routes?
No, you don't have to prove that. There is a spot that says what your mountaineering history is. And so it's a good idea to have some experience before you head this way. And so what we'll do is we're not going to tell anybody no that they can't come, but we will look over their application. And if it looks like there's no real experience in either high altitude or glaciated environments, Arctic environments, we might send them an email or give them a call and just see what their thinking is and make sure that they're really prepared for what they're getting into.
And are you trying to change minds in that call?
No. We're just, a lot of what we do here as rangers is we try to educate folks, and we feel like the more planning you can do on the front end for an expedition of this type and this length is going to really help you be safe and help your success. And maybe not success measured in summit, but success as a trip where everybody comes back happy and healthy. We spend a lot of our energy just trying to get people the right information. So what we will do is, instead of discouraging them, we'll point them in the right direction, make sure they have the right information. Maybe put some questions in their mind that they haven't thought of, and then ultimately they make their own decision.
And where, you know, I mentioned at the top of the show that it's an international mountain. Where are the climbers coming from? Can you kind of break that down?
Yeah, I'm sure, you know, as Brian and Colby will say, they're pretty much from all over the world. We kind of see our typical season, and it seems to fall within these parameters quite often, is like a 60-40 split. 60% being from the U.S. and then 40 from all other countries. And, you know, the leading countries I'd say that we see a fair amount of folks from are the U.K. and Canada, Russia, Japan, Korea. But the majority, that 60%, those are U.S. climbers. And it seems that the majority of the U.S. climbers are coming from Alaska, Colorado, Washington, California areas.
So is Alaska the number one state where people are going to
go? It has been, yeah. I didn't get too much time to look back too far, but it has been for the recent history, yeah.
And what are your main duties as a mountaineering ranger?
We have quite a diverse job. I'd say that number one, we kind of like to think of ourselves as in the education business a little bit, just trying to get information to people so that they can make good informed decisions. So we spend a lot of time talking to people about route conditions and equipment and planning and that kind of thing. We have a component to our job here in Talkeetna at the ranger station where everybody that comes through that registration process, I mentioned they have to be here. They have to register 60 days in advance, but not only that, they have to come through an orientation that we do here in town. And so whoever's on duty that day as one of the climbing rangers will sit down with that expedition, every member of the expedition, for anywhere from an hour to 2 hours and go through some kind of Denali-specific things in our briefing room. And talk about their expedition before they fly on. So that's a component of the job. Other big component is we go on to the mountain and we run a 30-day, anywhere from 25 to 30-day patrol on the West Buttress route. So that's our kind of field time, and we'll go from base camp just like everybody else does at the Cahilton Base Camp, 7,200 feet, and we'll climb our way up the mountain as the rest of the visitors do, and along the way we just kind of keep our eye out for behavior that's maybe a little more risky than others, and kind of educate folks on maybe techniques they haven't seen. We try not to be a very strong imposing presence. We'll just kind of be there in case people ask questions and need things, and along the way we'll clean up trash and make sure that people are respecting the place that they're in and the leave no trace ethics that we all try to use on the mountain. And then lastly, I'd say if that preventative SAR stuff that we like to call it, the educational side of things, preparedness isn't working, we have to get involved in any search and rescue efforts. We'll do that as well.
Okay, yeah, and we'll get more into that later in the hour. Colby, you're a guide and owner of a guide service. How does that work? I mean, if I wanted to climb the mountain and I knew that I wanted to go with a guide, what would I need to do?
Well, we do a fair amount of screening. We want the expedition to be successful for everyone on the trip. And the best way for it to be successful is if they're prepared as best as possible, and that is largely related to mountaineering skills that they need to have been quite comfortable with before they show up. Denali's not a good place to learn any of the mountaineering skills. It's a good area, the Alaska Range, for learning those skills on the smaller peaks, but the mountain itself, with the extreme cold and the high altitude, it compounds everything, and you don't want to be experiencing using crampons with a big backpack for the first time on something like that.
So do you have a certain amount of experience that you require?
We want to see 3 to 4 years of people using basic mountaineering skills, like self-arrest with an ice axe, cramponing on ice, icy slopes. The winter camping is a big component. You think it's mostly about climbing, but it's really about camping. And most of the problems that, or oftentimes the problems that people have are related to camping. And so we don't want people to freeze their water bottles because they've left them in their pack. They need to sleep with everything that they don't want to freeze. There's a fairly sophisticated amount of information you need to be familiar with regards to crevasse rescue. The mountain itself, the terrain isn't that difficult until you fall in a crevasse, and then all of a sudden it's quite difficult either to get yourself out or get one of your expedition members out, and involves some pretty intense and sophisticated rescue systems and building anchors and transferring loads and that sort of thing. So we don't want people showing up without a solid understanding of those rescue systems.
And is that typical for the guiding companies on Denali?
I can't speak for the other companies, but my guess is it's pretty typical. It's hard to know exactly how much experience someone has without going out climbing with them. But you need to explain the type of resume that you want to see and have them submit that. And you talk to them over the phone quite a bit and touch base with them throughout the winter on how their training trips are doing. And they want to pursue similar sort of objectives like Denali, just not as high, is really good. Just simulate the terrain that you're going to encounter on Denali somewhere else beforehand, that sort of thing.
Okay. And Brian, you have 2 decades of experience as a guide on the mountain and also had a guide company. You first climbed it in 1973, is that right?
That's correct.
And Can you describe that first expedition?
Well, it was with a group of friends. I was very young and probably didn't have enough experience to qualify as one of Colby's clients, but I was with a group of people that put a tremendous amount of trust in me and taught me along the way. It was an early season climb. It was in April, and we had the whole mountain to ourselves until we were coming down. We passed a group going up just a few hours out of base camp. So it was quite an experience. It was successful in that we all got along and had a great time. We didn't go to the top. It got too windy up high. But it was an amazing experience for me, and I was hooked.
So did you know on that climb that you were going to, spend a lot of your life on the mountain?
No, I sure didn't. Not at that time, but I knew I sure had an attraction to the big mountains. It was a wonderful place to be.
And how much different was it back then? I mean, you said that it wasn't crowded, certainly, and I don't know if it's crowded today, but there are a lot less people. What other ways was it different?
Well, there were far fewer people. That year, I think there were just over 250 people that attempted the mountain. Now, this year it's going to be somewhere over 1,000 probably. And for sure, guiding was not as sophisticated then. Guiding has become much more professional since that time. The techniques are very much the same. As Colby mentioned, the climbing itself is not technically demanding on the West Buttress, but it involves a very thorough understanding of general mountaineering techniques and skills to climb the mountain safely. And people have been quite good at those skills for a long time. The main thing is I was just with people that were so at ease in the mountains and spent many, many months climbing and summer and winter, and they taught me lots of safe techniques and ways to stay comfortable in the cold, how to take care of your equipment, how to take care of yourself, eating and drinking enough, and just enjoying being out there.
And what about things like weather updates? I mean, did you have, I assume you didn't have as much information as climbers have today on what what was going on with the weather?
No, we didn't. We never had any weather updates. We just get up in the morning and look at the weather and decide whether it was good enough to climb or not. And if the weather changed during the day, we would decide whether it was time to go back to our camp or push on to our next one or camp right where we were. So you didn't have that forecast available to you, but you got pretty good at reading the weather and making those judgment calls.
And give me an example of that. I mean, how do you read the weather?
Well, for one, a lot of changing weather is preceded by high clouds starting to move in, and as they move in, the highest summits like Denali and Four Acre will develop lenticular clouds over them, those classic cloud caps. And as it proceeds, the weather front will move in, and it'll start snowing, and the winds may increase. And so you look for those telltale signs, and you can play with it down low more, push the weather harder than you can up high. You get a feel for it, and you get caught by the weather a few times too. Sometimes on Denali, some of the worst weather many people encounter is actually quite low on the mountain, trying to just get through Kehultna Pass, which is the divide of the Alaska Range, and lots of weather is funneled right up the Kehultna Glacier and over the pass, and quite often it's windy and zero visibility and snowing very, very hard, and it totally obscures the terrain and the trail. And people get stuck all over on the upper Kehultna Glacier, unable to move. And then as the weather breaks and clears, you push on as far as you can and hopes that the weather remains good to get up around Windy Corner. And then up high on the mountain, you have to really respect the wind. The wind can be very, very cold. It's a cold environment, and you're moving very slow because of the low oxygen environment. And it's harder to stay warm when you're moving that slow, and it's harder to stay warm when the temperatures are very cold. So the wind becomes much more of a factor higher on the mountain than the lower regions. It's a lot of it is judgment, and a lot of it's experience, and a lot of it's knowing what the consequences can be of the weather.
And this year is a centennial of the first expedition, the first successful expedition on Denali, right?
That's right. It's the first 100 years ago. This year was the first ascent of the highest south summit of Denali by Hudson Stuck and Harry Carsons and Robert Tatum and Walter Harper.
And so, they were already making their way up the mountain,
They sure were. They had started from Fairbanks by dog team in March.
Wow.
And come across country and kind of entered the Wonder Lake area from Upper Moose Creek and actually met Charles McGonigal, one of the sourdough expedition members from 1910, and then made their way cross country to the northern foothills of the Alaska Range. And then ascended the Muldrow Glacier, which the Sourdough Expedition 1910 had pioneered as a way to get to the base of the mountain. And they had found what was later called Carson's Ridge, after Harry Carsons. They found that as a feasible route and were able to climb it up to the Harper Glacier, which is between the two summits of Denali, the north and the south summit. And the sourdoughs had gone to the north summit, but that left the higher south summit of the mountain to still be climbed, and it came very close to being climbed, just within a couple hundred feet in 1912 by an expedition that actually dog sledded all the way from Seward to get there. And then this day 100 years ago found Harry Carsons and Hudson Stuck and Harper and Tatum snowshoeing up to Muldrow Glacier, putting in a camp for finding a place to camp at the very head of the Muldrow Glacier at the base of Carson's Ridge. So they got up to about 11,000 feet and found it very different than the Belmore Brown expedition of 1912 or the Sourdough expedition had found it because there had been a huge earthquake after Belmore Brown descended, and huge avalanches, ice avalanches come down everywhere, and in particular, Carson's Ridge had totally been shattered. It was just a mess. Rather than being this nice, smooth, steep ice ridge, it was a jumbled pile of ice blocks and seracs and crevasses.
So what's it like for you to read that account?
Oh, it's really great. Just to imagine what it was like for these early climbers. Their gear was much less sophisticated. Their techniques were very crude. They were really good winter campers, but had really no climbing experience. But they figured it all out and got out there every day and pushed forward.
Do you fear for their safety while you're reading it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing that they didn't have more problems. They had a few dogs that fell in crevasses, and they actually had to lower Walter down one time to rescue a big dog named Snowball out of a crevasse and bring him back up to the surface.
Wow. So, yeah, very different. Okay, well, now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. Spring is here, and so are the girls. This weekend, the third annual Who Let the Girls Out Festival will take place in downtown Palmer. Events include a 5K timed run or untimed walk, the Palmer Spring Classic Bike Race, a wild and scenic film festival, and much more, with over 25 Palmer businesses participating. For more info on Who Let the Girls Out, go to palmeralaska.net. Also this weekend, UAA will host an outdoor gear swap and resource fair in the UAA Student Union on Saturday, April 27th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Do you have a garage full of old bikes, jackets, and fishing gear you'd like to get rid of? Have you been searching for a great deal on ice tools, skis, or a backpack? For more info on the gear swap, go to facebook.com/UAA gear. The 21st annual Talkeetna Trapper Creek Birdathon begins Friday, May 5th at 6 p.m. The competition lasts for 24 hours. Participants may take part as individuals, couples, or families. The objective is to find the highest number of species of birds while enjoying a great day and or night outdoors. For more info, go to talkeetnachamber.org. And we have links to all of these events at alaskapublic.org. Finally, the Alaska Heart Run, often considered to be the kickoff event for running season in Anchorage, is this Saturday. To tell us more about the 35th annual race today, we have with us Executive Director of the American Heart and Stroke Association in Alaska, Lisa Souter. Thanks for being here, Lisa.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And so describe the Heart Run.
Well, it's a great celebration of both people who have lost their battle with heart disease and stroke and those who have survived. We have wonderful families and stories that come out of the event every year. Many people come back year after year, maybe in memory of their grandfather or their uncle or their coworker. And it's a great time for people to come together and to celebrate those people. It's also a great way for us to reinforce with Alaskans the importance of living a healthy, active lifestyle.
And how competitive is the event?
Well, we have two components to the event. One is a competitive timed event. That will start at 9:30, and we have everybody from UAA runners to some real true athletes here in our community that run seriously, that compete, to people that'll come with their strollers and jog along towards the rear. And then we have our untimed event that starts at 10 a.m., which is really for everyone. And we offer both a 5K and a 3K option because we do have a lot of folks that come out that maybe are in cardiac rehab. They've just suffered a stroke or a heart attack and can't really do the full walk yet, but we want to have a way for them to participate as well. So it's really from all levels of fitness, and no matter whether you want to come out and run the full 5K or come out for a nice stroll on a Saturday morning, we have something for everyone.
And how many people do each event?
We have about 2/3 of the participants are actually in the untimed event. So we'll have about 3,000 people this year in the untimed event and about 2,000 in the timed.
And how much overall does the race help raise awareness for heart disease?
I think it does a lot. We get tremendous local media support, such as yourself. And making people aware is so important. It's important for everyone to know their risk factors, to know their numbers, to take care of themselves, to be healthy, to be active. A big component of the event, too, is the school teams. And it's a great way for us to encourage young people to get out and to be active with their friends and their family.
Okay, and can people still sign up?
Absolutely. Little secret for your listeners today, we will take timed registration still on Friday. This is not widely known, so a little scoop for you here. They can come to the bib pickup in person on Friday from 4:30 to 6:30 at King Career Center and still register for the timed event. They can still sign up for the untimed online, come to bib pickup, or even the morning of the event. We don't encourage it, but we would certainly rather have you come and show up and participate than not come at all.
Okay, well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for your support. And again, to everybody out there who's participated in the Heart Run, please come out and join us. We've already raised over $210,000 for the fight against the number one killer of all Americans.
Okay, Lisa Sauter is Executive Director of the American Heart and Stroke Association in Alaska. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Annie Feit. Stay with us for the second half of the show when we'll continue our talk about the Denali climbing season when Outdoor Explorer continues on KSKA. Don't forget, KSKA is member-supported radio. KSKA's spring membership drive is this week, and programming relies on your financial support. Rachel Martin, host of NPR's Sunday Weekend Edition, tells us more.
Hi, this is Rachel Martin, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sundays on KSKA, where you can find The Puzzler with Will Shortz, Good Company on the ride home from work, with All Things Considered and Alaska News Nightly, and Outdoor Explorer Thursdays. KSKA and NPR exist for you. And thanks to your financial support, you're able to enjoy another day with public radio. Please make your pledge at alaskapublic.org. You spend your time with KSKA. Decide then that KSKA is worthy of your financial support. Pledge online at alaskapublic.org. KSKA, life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Annie Feit, and my guests today are Brian Okanek, former Denali climbing guide, Tucker Chenoweth, National Park Service climbing ranger on Denali, and Colby Coombs, owner of Alaska Mountaineering School and author of Denali, A Climber's Guide. We're talking about climbing Denali today, and one of the big issues on the mountain is human waste. I produced a story on the problem last year and talked to Mike Loso, a glaciologist from Alaska Pacific University. He calculates climbers on the mountain have generated more than 130,000 pounds of human waste over the years, and he wanted to answer a few questions about that.
Where is that waste going, and when is it going to melt out at the surface again? It wasn't a question that it would. Anyone who understands glaciers knows it's going to come back, but when and where?
In 2007, Loso began studying those questions during a research expedition on the West Buttress Route, the most popular way to climb Denali. And the answer he eventually found to that when question is surprisingly soon. Loso says his calculations are conservative, but predicts the waste will begin surfacing on the lower Kahiltna Glacier in 15 to 25 years.
We can't say it precisely, but I think the important piece of that finding is it's not centuries away. It's soon. Given the potential errors in our estimate, it's even possible that it's melting out now, although we don't think so. But it's within the lifetime of the people managing this mountain, these waste piles are going to start to emerge on the surface. That's what we think.
Loso, with graduate student Katie Goodwin, also found that when the waste does emerge, it will still be quite potent. It turns out inner glaciers, which are dark and cool, are very good at preserving the type of harmful bacteria, like E. coli and fecal coliform, that live in human waste. But Loso says because it will be surfacing in such a remote area, the waste doesn't represent a major risk to human health or to the environment.
This human waste is going into a very, very large ecosystem that it's difficult to argue is at all threatened by these quantities. You know, we could do the math and figure out how many kilograms of bear poop are out there, and, you know, we'd come up with a huge number, too.
But it is a problem the National Park Service will have to pay attention to in the years ahead, and no one is more aware of that than Roger Robinson, a mountaineering ranger on Denali.
People do travel down that way,
So it'd be something that we, Park Service, will have to manage very closely once we start finding this stuff.
Robinson is passionate about keeping the mountain clean, and he says Denali is in vastly better shape today than when he first began his job more than 3 decades ago. Today, all climbers are required to use clean mountain cans, small bear canister-like toilets that can be strapped to a backpack or sled. A lot of the human waste collected in the cans is flown off the mountain, but he says in the past, most of the waste ended up in crevasses or pit toilets.
We had a lot of pit toilets that were used for the past 35 years or more out of Kiltna Base Camp. And once those start coming out, those will be huge piles of human waste that'll be surfacing.
Climbers are still allowed to throw their waste in crevasses in the middle section of the main climbing route. Robinson would like to see the National Park Service require all waste be carried off the mountain. But he says new regulations are tricky to pass, especially ones that would require climbers to carry more weight and pay more money. But Robinson says it would be worth the extra expense and effort.
There's just no reason to have the prime mountain of, you know, the Americas, Denali, filthy as it once was. And we need to keep it. It is a wilderness mountain, and we need to keep it in that state.
Loso, a climber himself who spent a summer as a junior ranger on Denali, says it's a tough issue. He doesn't think it's necessary for climbers to pack all of their waste off the mountain, but he also doesn't like the idea of spoiling, even in a small way, a remote wilderness area. He says he doesn't buy the argument that we shouldn't worry about a place that sees so few visitors.
Since when does the National Park Service make the argument that the places that are least visited are therefore okay to contaminate or to pollute? It's the opposite. The Park Service, puts on a high pedestal these places that are the most remote and the most wild, and they protect them the most intensely. And here that management practice is sending the contaminants to that very place. And I think that's the hard question.
And Colby, what do you think? How big of a problem is human waste on the mountain?
Well, I think the Clean Mountain Can has taken care of the issue for the most part. It's a lot cleaner place than it used to be. And when you think of waste, you often think of human waste, but equally important is all our food supplies that they are cached in a way that the ravens won't get at them. Because that could easily happen if stuff isn't buried 3 meters deep and piled and then marked really well with wands. But the Clean Mountain Can has made it very simple, regardless of your nationality or your understanding of English. It's pretty simple. You go in the can. And what makes it feasible on Denali is that we haul sleds all the way up to 14,000 feet. I think it would be a different story if we were carrying those cans on our backs the whole time, because there's only so much weight you can really carry. But Denali, the west buttress of Denali, is unique because the route is moderate enough angled to be able to haul a sled halfway up the mountain.
And Brian or Tucker, do you want to weigh in here?
Well, this is Brian. I agree 100% with Roger in that the mountain is much cleaner today than it was when I first started climbing the mountain in the early 70s. And it's been proven now that you can haul human waste off the mountain, and because people are accessing the mountain by the most part by flying in to Hilton Base Camp and flying out. And as Colby said, you use sleds on the lower half of the mountain, so it's pretty easy to sled that human waste back to base camp and fly it off, and it'll make the mountain the most pleasant place to be in the future for future generations of climbers on the mountain itself and on the lower Kahiltna.
And would it even be feasible to carry all of the human waste off the mountain, like even on the upper portions?
Cool. Yeah, it has been done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what we're doing now.
You are.
All the waste is getting hauled off the mountain for the West Buttress route.
Okay. I thought there were still sections where you didn't have to use the Clean Mountain Cans.
No, yeah, all the way to...
This is Tucker. The cans are...
Some outfits or expeditions are voluntarily taking all their waste off, and that's encouraged. And but it is not mandatory that they do that. But as you stated, in the center of the West Buttress Route, around 11,000 feet, and various areas, there's places that you can put it into the glacier as long as it's below the surface. So some people are doing it, all of it, and others aren't. So right now it's not 100%.
Okay. And Tucker, what about trash? Is that a big issue?
I don't think it's as big an issue. I've heard the stories from Roger and Brian. It's nowhere near what it used to be. And Colby had a good point about the ravens up there. They'll get into people's stuff and scatter trash around. But if you go up on Denali now, you won't see much trash. People are pretty good. The leave no trace ethic is pretty ingrained in folks. I guess we sometimes see different cultures maybe have a different mountain ethic occasionally, but once folks get here, they all seem to agree that it's nice to keep it clean as it is, and everybody seems to do their part. So we don't have a big problem with it. Every year we'll go in and we'll do end of the season cleanup, and we end up pulling some trash off, but nowhere near what it used to be.
And are some of the international climbers, especially, are they surprised by how clean it is?
Yeah, I think as far as being one of the seven summit peaks, it's arguably one of the cleanest.
Okay. And I should say you're listening to Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about climbing Denali with National Park Service Mountaineering Ranger Tucker Chenoweth, guide Colby Coombs, and former guide Brian Okunik. And I want to make sure we talk about the risk of climbing Denali. In the last couple years, 15 people have died on the mountain in the last 2 years. Tucker, is that an unusually high rate?
No, it's not unusually high. Denali goes through ebbs and flows some years with seeing zero fatalities, and other years it sees more. Last year we had a higher rate. I think there were 9 fatalities last year. Last year was 6. The year before was 9. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of increasing trend. Our numbers are about staying the same, and it seems like those numbers are fatalities are staying about the same as well. I don't know what I'd like to hear from Colby and Brian about what their opinion of that is.
Well, I can chime in.
Yeah.
When I climbed Denali first when I was 18 and a client of Brian's, I certainly felt safe, even though we ended up doing a couple rescues and we were held up in a cave on a couple different occasions, staying out of high winds. We had an awesome summit day, and there wasn't a time that I felt that my life was in jeopardy. And today, when I go up this summer, I'm not going to feel like Denali is a place that I will die. It's sort of like negotiating highways in L.A. If you don't look left or right, they're very hazardous. But the hazard's pretty understandable, and the way to manage it is pretty meat and potatoes, basic mountaineering. And Brian, since he taught me everything, could probably add to that.
Yeah, so Brian, what are kind of the basics of managing the risks on Denali?
Well, it starts before you even get there. It starts with, with proper training and a proper apprenticeship in mountaineering and doing your planning, starting off with enough fuel to melt all the snow you need for water and food you need for calories and the proper equipment you need to stay warm and provide shelter for yourself, and equipment you need for climbing itself and protecting yourself on steep terrain and being prepared for crevasse rescue while you're traveling on the glaciers, and then practicing those skills and having a good understanding between you and your team members of how a rescue would take place, whether if one team member fell into a crevasse or if somebody got hurt on a steep slope, and recognizing the risk in the mountains, the objective hazards such as crevasses and weak snow bridges and unseen crevasses that are hidden by bridges and ice falls and seracs and avalanche conditions, the problems associated with high altitude, how people are affected by acute mountain sickness and more serious things such as pulmonary edema and cerebral edema, and communicating with all your partners, everybody being honest with each other about how they're feeling, whether they're feeling up for the day health-wise, what their psyche is, if they're feeling comfortable with the climbing techniques themselves. There's lots and lots of variables that go with it, but you just break it down into one day at a time, one step at a time, and keep looking around and managing the risk on a continual basis. Every day it starts off looking at the weather and getting breakfast down and filling up your water bottles and starting off from camp with warm feet and warm hands and not letting yourself get too cold nor too hot on the trail, and getting a snack in before you bottom out, and then evaluating the snow conditions and looking around. A lot of people end up sometimes on the West Buttress, just following that trail and not looking around at the whole picture, looking at, is this trail really in the safest place it can be? Isn't it going maybe too close to that hanging glacier or crossing a snow bridge that's very questionable when the trail could easily go around that same crevasse? And setting up camps in proper places and playing by the rules of the game. You travel roped up on a glacier to prevent anybody from plunging all the way to the bottom of a crevasse. But then when you're traveling, you've got to maintain proper rope management. You've got to have proper amount of slack or lack of slack in the rope. You've got to probe out places where you have rest stops and bring the team together, or where you're going to camp to make sure everybody is in a safe zone. And then you got to mark that perimeter to make sure everybody knows where the safe zone is and they stay within that zone. And so that goes all the way up. And there's double checks you do on each other. You make sure your partner is tied correctly to their seat harness and their carabiners are locked and they've got appropriate gear accessible in case there's a crevasse rescue, and they've got the appropriate gear for going to the summit. And you just, if you dot your I's and cross your T's, you can eliminate many risks and you can lower other risks and make it quite a safe adventure. But if you just blunder along and don't look around, it can be a very, very dangerous place.
And you make it sound manageable when you're the guide. But when you own a company, and you're dealing with guides under you and you're trusting them to have that same smart decision making, I mean, is that a little scary to let them do that? And how do you manage that?
Well, it's not scary if you've worked with those guides. You know what their judgment is like and what their skills are like, but you do have to once they leave and you're not on the trip, they're in total control, and you have to trust their judgment that they're gonna do the right thing, and safety is gonna be utmost important on their mind.
And Colby, how do you feel about that?
I agree. You need to trust your guides, and you don't have them work for you on Denali the first time. You do other things, so there's a progression, and you get feedback from the other guides that they're working with, and there's a evaluation process and a briefing and a debriefing, and you build up confidence in the new guide from talking with your trusted, more senior guides, so there's a mentorship that needs to happen, and it takes years.
Okay. And do you end up with clients that are really pushing to get to the summit, And I mean, I assume you do because that's what they're there to do. And how do you deal with that where you're, you know, safety is your number one?
Well, I want them to push. It's a hard mountain. I need people to be working hard and doing everything that they can do in their control to make sure that by the time they get to high camp, they're in decent shape still. They've taken care of themselves. They're staying hydrated. They're eating, that sort of thing. It's a difficult 12-hour minimum or maximum. It's an average 12-hour summit day. So you do need to push. You know, sure, someone could push too hard, and that's a difficult one to assess. So when you're communicating with people one-on-one and asking them how they're doing, you're trying to read them. What's unique about Denali, it's a three-week trip. So all the things that Brian listed, all the hazards that need to be managed, it's not all on one day. Each part of the mountain has its own host of difficulties and ways to prepare and indicators that let you know whether you're in good shape or maybe you need to stop and camp for the night. The mountain changes as you go higher and the hazards change. And over time, you build confidence in your crew. And hopefully, by the time you get to 14, you've got a pretty well-oiled machine so that when you put in the highest camp at 17, people know what to do already, and they're participating in every single aspect of building that camp. And so you just need to be really observant of every member. And it's particularly difficult if there's any sort of language barrier. So it's important that there is not a language barrier, because when you ask someone how they're doing and they just say, "I am fine," with no really way of telling, then that becomes difficult. And altitude illness is the hardest type of thing to predict in people.
And explain that more. You don't know who's going to be affected by it.
True. They're not everyone. It's a genetic thing. And it's more than just that, but it is also a genetic thing where someone that's super strong and shows every sign of strength lower on the mountain, all of a sudden bonks higher on the mountain. And you attribute that to altitude-related problems. And that's the toughest thing, because summit day is such a big 3,000-foot day that you know, hopefully everyone that's at 17, they're showing all the signs of strength and no signs of altitude, but it can creep up really fast. So you're always having to look over your shoulder and see how people are doing. And when you stop for a break, are they immediately putting their parka on and they're standing up and staying warm and eating and drinking, or are they slumped over on their pack getting cold? Those are the sorts of things you got to be looking out for, and you might only get a little hint, so you really need to be observant. It might not be obvious.
And have you had to turn around people who just look like they, you know, didn't have like the big classic signs, but look like they just weren't?
I've only summited Denali with a full expedition of the people that started the trip once, and they were all cancer survivors in the most unlikely group. I thought to fully summit. So, Wow. Yeah, it's typical to turn people around.
And how, I mean, do you get people arguing with you about that?
Generally, you know, if you are, the best way to do it is that they come to you and they tell you, "This is more than I thought." And you have to nurture them to do that by touching base with everyone during every day. And letting them know, "Wow, you know, you had a hard day today and you're not recovering. Let's see how tomorrow goes. And maybe Denali's not right for you right now," sort of thing. So you get it. You have to be up front soon and not make it a shock to them later if you think that they potentially won't make it. But that generally, people come to me and say that you're right. I'm too exhausted. I'm not waking up in the morning feeling like I can do it all over again. And they realize the seriousness of the mountain being out there over a period of a week or something like that. And they want to go home all by themselves.
And Tucker, when something does go very wrong and there's an accident, how do the Rangers respond? Can you walk us through a typical rescue scenario?
Yeah, well, I guess the first thing I'd say is that there doesn't seem to be a typical rescue scenario.
Exactly.
It seems we get surprised by each one. They're all pretty different. But what we mostly stand on is that these teams will be self-sufficient. The reality of Denali is that it's a wilderness mountain, and rescue capabilities are pretty unlikely. Everything has to line up perfectly for things to happen. And when that happens, when things line up, and when I say that, I'm thinking that the weather, most everything that happens up there needs some sort of air assistance. And so the weather from Talkeetna to the mountain has to be good. The weather on the mountain has to be okay. And then the teams on the mountain have to be in an area where they're in proximity to respond. So all those things need to line up, and occasionally they do, where we can be in the right place at the right time and truly help somebody. So when that happens, we have a rescue helicopter here in Talkeetna that can fly altitudes all the way up towards the summit, and we have kind of a toolbox of rescue techniques depending on the situation that we're faced with to do whatever it takes to get folks off. But our safety as rescuers is always priority, and it's I'll be honest with you, it's a difficult thing to do. And if somebody goes on to a mountain like Denali and expects there to be backup or assistance, rescue at the touch of a phone or a satellite phone call, they're making a pretty grave mistake, because really it depends on the team that you choose way beforehand, like Brian was saying, before you even get to the mountain, and all the preparation and planning you've done. And then if everything goes wrong and you have that team, then the chances of actually getting help might be there, and then we'll be there to back up that initial help. But the initial help is going to come from your team or somebody around you. A lot of times we as the National Park Service will lean on the skills of the guides. So the folks that are up there, they're usually are always highly skilled folks that know the mountain well. So we have a staff of 10 people, and at any time we're kind of spread out on the mountain. So the guides assist us a lot, and it becomes kind of a team rescue environment where private climbers will help. You know, if somebody needs help on the mountain, it becomes you're limited by your resources, and those resources become everybody that's around.
And there's now a cap of 1,500 climbers. Is that partly because at a certain point they're just, you know, too many to deal with for if things do go wrong, or is that more of a resource?
I mean, that would be too many to deal with, but I think it's more of a resource. It's a resource conservation, I think, initially, and that rule has been in place for some time now, and we've never reached it. So we've never had to cap the number of climbers. And so we don't really know what that even looks like. We already know that it feels pretty crowded at times, because that 1,500 is not limited into like a Grand Canyon permit, for example, that you have to choose certain weeks. It's not like that. You can come all in 1 week if you want to, all 15. It doesn't happen that way. But we were just talking today and thinking that I've probably seen around 450 people at one time stacked up at 14 camp, which is too many. You know, it becomes hard, and not on a rescue, not for rescue, but more for just the problems that many people in one area create. You know, there's social dynamics. It's like trying to catch a wave when you're surfing, too. It's like there's just too many people, and people aren't experiencing that area the way that I think they all initially sign up to do the climb to experience it that way.
Okay, well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for being on the show. We had Colby Coombs, owner of Alaska Mountaineering School, Tucker Chenoweth, National Park Service Mountaineering Ranger on Denali, and Brian Okunik, former Denali climbing guide. Next week on Outdoor Explorer, Charles Woolforth will be talking about summer camp planning for kids. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer and audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Annie Feit. Happy trails.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.